Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
Today is the day that Judge Rohin decides my fate, whether I will leave the country or I will stay in this country with my family.
Today, we bring you the case we have been following for nearly 2 years of Faisal Olvi. He was picked up by immigration authorities in 2002. Today, the decision whether he stays here or is returned to Pakistan. We'll speak with Faisal Olvi, his wife, and his lawyer. Then we turn to the case of another Pakistani immigrant. He photographed a reservoir in upstate New York nearly 3 years ago. He has now been detained and is set to be deported. And we turn to Southern California, where Border Patrol agents have arrested hundreds of undocumented workers and immigrants in sweeps conducted well inside the U.S.-Mexico border. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Saddam Hussein appeared in court today in Baghdad. An Iraqi tribunal headed by Salem Chalabi will try Hussein and 11 other top Ba'athist officials for crimes against humanity. Saddam Hussein rejected charges of war crimes and genocide against him in a court appearance today, telling a judge, quote, "This is all theater. The real criminal is Bush." Saddam's hands were cuffed when he was brought to the court, but the shackles were removed for the arraignment, which lasted about 30 minutes. Salem Chalabi is the nephew of disgraced Iraqi politician Ahmed Chalabi. Salem is the law partner of Israel Mark Zell, who is a close associate with Douglas Feith, one of the top backers of the Iraqi invasion. Feith is the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy and headed the Pentagon's Office of Special Plans. The Army officially announced yesterday that 5,600 former soldiers will be forced out of retirement and back into active duty to fight in Iraq. The call marks the first time since the Gulf War that the Pentagon had to tap into the individual ready reserve pool. Nearly one of every five U.S. soldiers returning from Iraq and Afghanistan is showing signs of post-traumatic stress disorder. This, according to a new report in the New England Journal of Medicine. In addition, less than half the soldiers who reported mental disorders have sought treatment. The U.S. has attacked sites in Fallujah, killing up to 15 people. Military officials said the attack target a suspected hideout of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who the U.S. claims is a leader of the Iraqi resistance. Meanwhile, in Washington, the Bush administration announced it had raised the reward for Zarqawi's capture from $10 to $25 million. In Baghdad, a senior finance ministry official was killed, along with two others, in a roadside bombing. And in other Iraq news, Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez has stepped down as the top U.S. commander in Iraq. He was replaced by a four-star general, General George Casey. The Guardian of London is reporting that on the day after the so-called handover of power in Iraq, the U.S. military police raided a detention center being operated by the Iraqi Ministry of the Interior in Baghdad. At one point, the U.S. threatened to free all the Iraqi prisoners. The incident raised new questions as to how much sovereignty the new Iraqi government actually has. The U.S. said they carried out the raid because they had received reports that Iraqi interrogators were physically abusing the detainees. The 150 prisoners had all been picked up in what was described as the first Iraqi-led anti-crime and anti-terrorism operation. In Hong Kong today, hundreds of thousands of protesters took to the streets in a massive demonstration calling for democracy in the former British colony. The march came on the 7th anniversary of Chinese retaking control of Hong Kong. Opposition to Beijing has intensified since China ruled earlier this year that Hong Kong would not be given the right to directly choose its next leader. Organizers said the total number of protesters topped 350,000 despite intense heat. A new report by the Association for Civil Rights in Israel has found the scope and gravity of Israeli human rights violations in the Palestinian territories has reached unprecedented levels. The report cites the killings of innocent Palestinian civilians in the occupied territories, as well as the construction of the massive separation wall through the West Bank. The human rights group was most critical of the Israeli military invasion of Rafah in May. The report read, quote, "Soldiers opened fire indiscriminately, prevented the evacuation of the injured, killed dozens of people, some of whom were armed, but many more of whom were innocent children, women, and men." The Department of Homeland Security has issued a warning to airport security officials to examine all Pakistanis arriving at key U.S. airports to check if they have any visible injuries that might suggest they trained at a Pakistani terror camp. The passengers will be checked for rope burns, unusual bruises, or scars. It is the first such warning that specifically targeted passengers from one country. The bulletin was sent to customs inspectors at international airports in Washington, New York, Newark, Detroit, Chicago, and Los Angeles. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of you who are listening or viewing the show or catching it on the internet on democracynow.org.
Well, we are later in the show going to be bringing you the case of a family we have been following for 2 years, the family of Faizeen Olvi and Nadine Young. Today is the day a judge will make a decision in a Manhattan court about whether Faizal Olvi will be sent back to Pakistan, despite the fact that he's married to an American citizen. But that's coming up next.
But first, we're going to go to this case, a Pakistani immigrant who was detained almost 3 years ago after taking pictures of an upstate New York reservoir, lost his fight to stay in the United States on Tuesday. Ansar Mahmood came to the U.S. in 2000 after receiving a diversity visa in an immigration lottery. He found work as a pizza delivery man in Hudson, New York, and there he would manage to send about $500 a month home to his family in Pakistan, where 9 siblings depended on his financial help. In October 2001, he was arrested for taking photographs of a reservoir in the Catskill Mountains. He has remained behind bars ever since.
No terror-related charges were ever filed against Mahmood, but investigators found him in minor violation of immigration law. He had signed an apartment lease, helped pay rent, and registered a car in his name for a young Pakistani couple with expired visas.
In January 2002, Mahmood pleaded guilty to harboring aliens and was sentenced to time served and 5 years probation. An immigration judge later ordered him returned to his native Pakistan. Mahmood's case became a cause for the residents of upstate New York, Democratic Senators Hillary Rodham Clinton and Charles Schumer, as well as 20 Congress members, were among lawmakers who lent their support. but they were not able to prevent his deportation. He lost his final judicial appeal on Tuesday. The government decision said, quote, after reviewing all pertinent correspondence, it has been determined that the safety and security of the United States far outweighs the amount of publicity that has been generated in this case. Mahmoud now faces a certain deportation unless he is granted a last-minute reprieve. He joins us on the phone from jail.
Ansar Mahmoud, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much and welcome to you.
Can you tell us where you are?
I'm in Batavia, New York.
And can you describe more fully your case, how you ended up in jail, and what this latest decision means?
As you just describe it, you know, what happening in my case, you know, when I take the picture and one of the security guard take my picture and second call to the police because he looked like I'm a Middle Eastern man. When because I have Domino car on sign on my car, and when later on police arrest me, and after a few hours when the authority came, the FBI and CIA and some other immigration, they try to investigate, and finally at the end they find out nothing, but they keep promising me all the time. They say, you have green card, you are right, just, you know, follow our advice, whatever we're saying, just say this one and you'll be all right. They try to promise me they can going to release me in the morning. They're not done. They say, you just go in a court, they release you over there. And then the later on, when the judge say that the court did after 5 days and nothing to happening, then I look to them and they're smiling, and they left me over there. After 5 days, the marshal again bring me in a court, and then they try to say the plea, but I don't know what reason, they again send me back. And next day in the morning, before I go in a court, very short, when the government lawyer, they met me, they say, if you do plea, you just help these guy to apartment and car, and this is not a big deal. We can release you after, just plea this one. Same thing, tell to the judge in front of them. I done this one, and they, you know, they are very professional. They know that what is going to happening, and they make a very strong setup. And at that time, I don't know what's going on, what's going to happening if I do plea. I think about I have green card, I'm all right. But when I do plea, they say we release you, they release me. But when the sentence is happening, and I still here like more than 2 years, more than close to 3 years.
And how long was it before you had access to a lawyer or to anyone who was able to visit you?
I have no access during my investigation. Even I see a lot of things in the TV. They say, stay silent. If you need your attorney, we can provide you anything you say. We use you against nothing like that. Anybody say to me anything about that. And before I hearing in a court, I told you like maybe 5 minutes, 10 minutes, that's the public defender came to me and they say, you help your family. You just help these people. It's okay. You know the circumstances right after that 1 month after 9/11. And, you know, just say same thing in front of judge. I think it's all right. They release you, and they say they give you bond. And same thing I done. And judge at that time asking when I do plea, asked to the government, like, do you have anything, objection? It's bare. They say nothing. They release me on that time. And maybe few minutes, the government lawyer meet me before the plea. Even the thing about like that, how much they do quick. I'm in a federal court in Albany, but the federal judge is not there because they want to wrap it up quick, this one. And I'm on the TV, judge is on TV screen. I'm in Albany Federal Court, but judge is not there. They want to finish quick because they know that this is not, if they're going to the fire, this is going on trial, they're not going to win this one because they make it this one. I'm not responsible. These people who came this country, they came this with a visa, and I never asked them, what's your status? You are illegal, illegal. Even I can't, nobody asked me, you have green card. They just told me they came in a visa, and they expired their visa.
We're talking to Ansar Mahmoud, who is in a detention facility in Batavia, New York. When I was up in Albany several weeks ago, this was the main case that people were talking about in a gathering of close to 1,000 people. People were holding up signs. They were passing around petitions to call for Ansar Mahmoud to be released and not to be deported to Pakistan. We're also joined on the line by Irem Sheikh, who has recently received her doctorate from the University of California, Berkeley Ethnic Studies Department. She wrote her dissertation on post-9/11 detainees and has interviewed dozens of detainees and people who've been deported already, including Ansar Mahmood, who she speaks with regularly. She herself was born in a Pakistani town near where Mahmood's family still lives. Can you put Ansar Mahmood's case in larger context, Irum Sheikh?
Sure, Amy. Thank you for having me. You know, as an ethnic studies scholar, I pay attention to the role race plays in the detentions that happened after 9/11. And over the last 2 years for my dissertation, I interviewed 50-plus people, men especially, who were arrested after September 11th. And one after the other interview confirmed that it was race, it was their looks, or their name, or their ethnicity that made them suspicious. It was nothing about their behavior. Now, look at Ansar's case. If I put a white man, white-looking man, in the same situation, I wonder if the security guard is going to call FBI or the local police. And if we follow the same case, I wonder if that young white man will be subject to interrogation like Ansar was, and what the outcome was going to be. Would he be detained like Ansar is? So in one case after the other, this same pattern of racial profiling, same pattern of intense investigation to show that the government is doing something has been showing up in all these cases. Another thing that I want to confirm, that there is a image out there that all the people who were arrested after September 11th had violations with their immigration. Ansar Mahmood is one of those cases where he did not have any immigration violation. He had a valid green card, and yet he became subject to government racial profiling and government scrutiny and surveillance. So it's not that only the people who had immigration violation are becoming subject to these interrogations. There are many people that I met who had legal visas, whether visiting legal visas or green cards or even citizenships, and the government went after them and they found them guilty of something.
Well, Irum Sheikh, you've also interviewed many people at the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn and are working on a book on the situation there. Could you talk a little bit about what you found in terms of the what they're experiencing, those who are being held at that detention center?
Well, Metropolitan Detention Center is a unique example of police power and government power, abuse of the police power and the state power. It is a ninth floor of Metropolitan Detention Center right after September 11th was converted. On September 14th, to be specific, it was converted into a special administrative maximum special housing unit, which meant that the people who were placed in that jail, they were subject to very, very strict confinement. They were, the Office of Inspector General reports is that there were 87 people placed there. I believe there were many more than that, maybe 100 plus. And these people were placed in solitary confinement, and many of them were abused physically. Of course, we're talking about mental and emotional abuse also. And most of these, I mean, I think the government has not found any one of those guilty of carrying out September 11th attacks. And most of these people have been deported back. And I wonder about the government's effectiveness in carrying out its homeland security apparatus. What is the result that we are achieving by putting people in high security jails after we found nobody has been found guilty of carrying out these attacks? So I'm concerned and disappointed at the Department of Homeland Security for keeping innocent people like Ansar Mahmood and many other people that I interviewed on a very personal level. They didn't have any connection with terrorism. I don't know what General Ashcroft is always constantly talking about, these terror threats. I think he personally knows that none of these people have any connection with terrorism, but yet he wants to prevail a climate of fear. And I think that's what he's trying to do.
We're talking to Aram Sheikh, who is interviewing deportees and people who have been detained in this country, and she goes to their home country to talk with families there. I wanted to ask you, Aram Sheikh, about this latest news of the Department of Homeland Security issuing a warning to airport security officials to examine all Pakistanis arriving at key U.S. airports to check if they have visible injuries that might suggest they've been at some kind of training camp.
You know, I heard that, and I was just laughing. Like, how are they going to do that? Are they going to ask people to strip? How are they going to find those visible scars? And how many people are going to become subject to that interrogation and where it will lead? Where the information is coming from? There are millions of people in Pakistan, and how many of them visit on a daily basis, and how many of those are going to become subject to this interrogation and where it will lead? I don't want to even fathom. And I believe I am one of them. And would I become subject to that interrogation and where the information is originating? All the other research that shows that the government does not have valid information, it's based on some assumptions and assumption about one or two persons, and then that leads into a blanket policy. And is that an effective strategy? Is an effective surveillance strategy? I just really would like the Department of Homeland Security to put themselves in that in that situation, and then think about developing those policies. We was talking with Ansar last night about the similar kind of an issue, and I would like Ansar to talk about this thing, what he thinks about the government, what happened to him, and what his attitude is towards the U.S. government.
Before we do that, we're speaking with Aram Sheikh, got her doctorate at University of California, Berkeley, doing a documentary and book on what has happened to immigrants in this country after 9/11, those who've been detained and deported. And we're speaking to Ansar Mahmood, a Pakistani immigrant who is scheduled now to be deported. We're talking to him from a detention facility in New York. We are doing this special today on immigrants on this Independence Day weekend, on the eve of it, holiday that celebrates immigrants coming to this country and establishing a new country. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
Is that freedom train to come?
Danger, 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 danger
Freedom Train, Sweet Honey in the Rock, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We are talking to Irum Sheikh, who has just finished her degree at University of California, Berkeley, doing a book and documentary on what's happening with immigrants. And we're speaking with Ansar Mahmood in jail. He is a Pakistani immigrant scheduled to be deported, detained almost 3 years ago when he was picked up October 2001 for taking photographs in front of a reservoir upstate New York in the Catskills. Juan?
Yes, Ansar, I'd like to ask you, in terms of contact with your family throughout this time, you had many brothers, siblings in Pakistan who were depending on your income for financial aid. What kind of contact have you had with family members?
Usually they have available here to, I can debit call to in Pakistan. I usually call like once a week or twice a week. And all the time I tell them, you know, I'm soon released. Even they don't know what's going on. You know, think about that. They're not going to deport only to me. They're going to deport all my 9 family members. They're not keep me here only to me in 30 months. They keep my all 9 family members in 30 months in a jail. When they eat, what is all the time? My mother think about, did my son eat? When they sleep, my mother all the time think about, did my son sleep? What are they thinking about? They all the time, even they don't know what's going on, the circumstances with me. I'm try to tell them I'm all right, I'm okay. But this is the mother heart, this is the father heart. They cannot believe it. They know that they send me here something, my good future. The good future of the whole family. They don't want to send me here. Excuse me. Send me here to in a jail all the time. When I came here, they changed their life. Everything, I just spent 15, 16 months before the arrest. Everything is changed. They changed my all 3 sisters in the school, the best school in the city, the English grammar school. They got good education. When suddenly this thing happening, they cannot go back everything. They cannot stop everything. But I don't know what's going on over there. I don't know. What can I tell them? I'm going to deport. I think about, I'm not going to tell them. Just go back like that. Then my mother not say anything wrong when I am home. But she wants their son is alive. Their son is in good health. Money is not big deal. But when I'm leaving this country, I don't know when, but I think about when this country I came. I feel it freedom. I feel it. Lot of respect, lot of love. They're not going to finish that way. It's not going to end. They're going to move strong and stronger. And I believe more and more this country, they have democracy here. But the, you know, who belong to the country? Who's the people belong? That's the people. That's not few people who in authority, they, whatever they want to do. This country belongs to the immigrant. They came here. They built up this country. And I look at, when I look at this picture, I look at to the Susan, I look at the Bob, I look at to the Irum. Look at to the Whitney Stone, who helped me. They never know me before when I'm in a hard time. When you find out who's your best friend, then you can test it. You can see, you know, when you have a hard time, that's hard time when you find somebody helps you. That's your real friend, and they're helping me all the time. It's not my fight only. This is the fight of all the immigrants. When I give up, I lose everything. When I do plead guilty, then I ended up my case in 2003. All my appeals is finished at that time. The Chatham Peace Initiative group in Chatham, they take that aim and goal. They say, we try to find out. It's not going right thing. This is not going happening to in America, and we have to justify. And they don't justify. I fight my case 13 months. They fight 17, 18 months, and they keep fighting. They not give up. That's the way they leave it. When I'm leaving nice way. I came this country nice way. I don't want to show him I'm angry. I'm angry, but few people. But the majority is nice. I have to keep the remembrance of the majority, which one is, you know, there is nothing wrong in Pakistan. There is nothing wrong in America. Very good people in Pakistan. Very good people in America. That's the people belong to this country, belong to the nation, belong to the home, human society. That's why I want to leave.
Well, thank you very much, Ansar, and the thoughts of many people who are listening and viewing the show are with you. And Irum Sheikh, if people would like to in some way or other assist Ansar Mahmood, what can they do?
You know, there is, as you mentioned, that the district court has denied the appeal, but we still have a hope there is a possibility that one of the U.S. senators can propose, or one of the politicians can propose a private bill. It has happened in the past that a private bill can be sponsored and the government can ask ENSR to stay. So we are now asking politicians to sponsor a private bill which will make ENSR to stay. And it is a possibility, and I would really like the local public to call their politicians, especially Senator Schumer and Clinton, and Michael Honda's office in California has been working really closely with us, and we are hoping that one of us will take a lead in sponsoring a private bill. So if you could call them, we would really appreciate it. It will not only save one life, it will save many, many lives, and it will give us a hope. It will give us a hope that America stands for immigrants. So please call, especially in the New York area, since ENSR is in New York. But at the same time, I will say this is not a New York case only. This is a case for all the people in this nation. So anybody could call. Anybody could call their local legislators.
Well, we want to thank you both very much for being with us. Iram Sheikh, doing a film and book on the situation of detainees and deportees. And Ansar Mahmoud, last comment, as we speak to you from a Batavia, New York detention facility.
You know, I don't know what's going to happen. That's the guard. No, you know, the guard works their own ways. I'm a strong believer. I believe this one. What is happening in the future, either way, going to Pakistan or maybe release, that's God know. I love this country. I love forever. Where I am, whenever I go, when I'm in Pakistan, I bar in Pakistan. God bless to Pakistan. God bless to America. And thanks to all the people, especially a lot of people in California, all the congressmen and Michael Honda and all the senator here in New York and everywhere. I thanks to all the people. And thanks to you, you know, you give me chance to speak out about this issue and give me the opportunity to show them my view, what about the America, and thank you to the both your hosts.
Thank you very much, and we will continue to let listeners and viewers know around the country about your case, Ansar Mahmoud and Iram Sheikh. This is Democracy Now! As we move now to another story of immigrants caught in the post-9/11 snare in this country. On this eve of Independence Day, eve of a celebration of a country of immigrants. Juan.
We bring you a case we've been following now for nearly 2 years. It is the story of Faisal Ulvi, a Pakistani immigrant who came so close to being deported. He was on the airport tarmac when immigration authorities received a cell phone call from a federal judge ordering them to pull him off the plane. Ulvi traveled to the United States 7 years ago and applied for political asylum. But after he missed an asylum hearing, he received deportation orders. Ulvi remained in the country and married a U.S. citizen, Nadine Young. He helped raise Nadine's two children. 2 years ago, they had a child of their own named Shaheen.
You may remember this story well. We have brought it to you at various points in the case. I also wrote about it in my book, The Exception to the Rulers, where we describe Nadine Young Ulvi was in the shower in her Brooklyn apartment at 6:30 in the morning, November 8th, 2002, when she heard a crash at her door. Her 7-year-old daughter, Brittany, went to see what was happening. She was greeted by men who demanded to be let in. They'd broken down the front door of the apartment building. Nadine shouted to her daughter not to let them in, but the frightened girl screamed that they were police. Nadine leaped out of the shower, attempted to close the bathroom door while she put on her clothes. The men had already stormed inside and ordered her to keep the bathroom door open while she dressed. They shouted for Nadine's three young children to go into the bedroom. Then they ordered Nadine's husband, Faisal, a salesman in a clothing store, to get out of bed. Faisal Ulvi is a Pakistani taekwondo expert who traveled to the United States in 1996 for a martial arts competition, then applied for political asylum. Juan described what happened after that. Like so many others, the undocumented immigrant scratched out a living in 2001, though. He married Nadine Young, a U.S. citizen, helped raise Nadine's two children from a previous relationship, Devin and Brittany, and then they had their own daughter, Brittany, Shaheen, together. Well, that day, it was the immigration authorities who had broken down the door. 2 months later, though, the Young Ulvi family won a major victory. Federal immigration judge Patricia Rohan gave Faisal permission to file a marriage petition with the INS. The marriage interview took place in April of this year. Now the judge will decide whether Faisal must adjust his immigration status in the United States or return to Pakistan and apply for a visa to come back to his family. We welcome Faisal Ulvi here, along with Nadine Young, his wife, and Elizabeth Ouyang, who is their lawyer from the beginning of this trial and tribulation. Faisal Ulvi, let's begin with you. Today is the day. You go to court at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. What is at stake here?
Almost everything. Supposed to appear in front of Judge Ryan today. I'm grateful to her because today where I am today with my family is because of her only. If it was not up to her, I wouldn't be talking to you or would be with my family. It's almost 2 years. And every time I be in the court, I see her and she looks at me. She knows that everything is okay, that something went wrong. But it's hardly she can do anything because it's just a procedure of law that she has to put me through to. As you just have discussed, I just 2 months ago, we appeared in front of INS and we cleared our green card interview. It only lasted half a minute. I mean, it took 10 minutes, but they only asked me one question. Should be enough to satisfy them that everything is okay. But again, I have to thank her for every moment that I've been in this country, that without her permission, nothing would have been possible right now. And I hope today when I go to her and in front of her, last month she let me file for a status of adjustment within the United States. She could have denied it right there and then also that I have to go back to my country, but she chose to do it over here on the hardship of my family. Got a wife, got kids. And I think she do too, and she understands the situation I am too, and I can, you know, you can't separate a father from the kids. Everybody does mistakes, and I think I'm paying my dues, and I think she knows it too, and INS already should know it too. But all I hope today that at 3 o'clock, it's everything in my favor of my family, and, you know, by will of God. Let's see what happens.
And Elizabeth Ouyang, what are the constraints that the judge is under? What are the legal alternatives that she has in this case?
The judge has the discretion to grant Faisal permission to adjust the status in the U.S. What she will be weighing are his prior immigration violations against the strong and dire need for family reunification here. We're talking about a family of five. We're talking about a wife and three young children, ages 11, 9, and 3. This family needs stability. This family needs to be together. And the overwhelming evidence in support of Faisal as a good father, as a good husband, is stacked full, and they just celebrated Father's Day. Devon just had his graduation, and Faisal was there for both. And I believe strongly that Judge Rohan understands the importance of family reunification and unity here. This family will be irrevocably destroyed if they are forced to be separated.
Well, I mean, if the judge says that Faisal must return to Pakistan to then apply to come back in, what would that mean? Could he go and come back in a week?
It's essentially a death knell on this family because if he has to leave the country, there is a minimum 10-year bar because he had overstayed his visa. There is a waiver available, but the practicality, given the climate that we are in post 9/11, and the fact that he would be in Pakistan, and for us here in the U.S. to have to negotiate with the U.S. consulate in Pakistan to grant the waiver would be a phenomenal, monumental, uphill battle. And I would ask that, you know, people recognize what this family has been through the past 2 years. Faisal, in his own words, said to me, being detained for 2 months, he could deal with that, but what he couldn't deal with was being separated from his wife and children. And I'm really hoping and I'm praying that the judge will see the merits of this case and really put family unity and the principles of family unity above all else here.
And Nadine Young, I'd like to ask you, you've been sitting here, first of all, listening to the case of Ansar Mahmood and what he has gone through over the last 3 years. Your thoughts in terms of what you and your family have gone through over the last several years?
Listening to him on the phone reminded me of what my husband used to say when he was arrested. And it's so hard. It is. It's so hard because you wonder what your life will be with tomorrow. I'm listening to him say that he has a family of 9 to take care of. And my husband is the same way. He has a mother and 2 brothers who he supported. His father passed away when he was young. He has a family out here. So he's losing both ways. My children are losing both ways. And it's just hard. It's nerve-wracking. I just hope that today is the end and we can really come.
The judge will make a decision at 3:00 today. We're going to break and then come back to talk about this case. The dramatic moment when Judge Rohan, 2 years ago, when Faisal Ovi was actually on the airport tarmac, called with her cell phone to say that he should be removed from the plane, that he should not be deported.
And I'm eternally grateful for that. She gave us the opportunity.
We're talking with the Young Ovi family, Nadine Young Ovi and Faisal Ovi, as well as their attorney, Elizabeth Ouyang. We'll be back in a minute.
Papel, pa' una ciudad del norte yo me fui a trabajar, mi vida la dejé entre Ceuta y Gibraltar, soy una raya en el mar, fantasma en la ciudad, mi vida va prohibida, dice la autoridad, solo voy con mi pena, sola va mi condena. Correré mi destino por no llevar papel, perdido en el corazón de la grande Babilón. Me dicen el clandestino, yo soy el quiebraley, argelino clandestino, nigeriano clandestino, boliviano clandestino, mano negra ilegal.
Mano Charles and Clandestino here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We are with the Young Ovi family, Nadine Young, Faisal Ovi, and their attorney, Elizabeth Ouyang. Today at 3:00 in a New York court, they will go before Judge Patricia Rohan, and she will decide the fate of this family, whether it will remain together or whether Faisal Ovi will be forced out of the country and sent back to Pakistan. the second part of the story 2 years ago, after the immigration authorities broke into the apartment, took Faisal Olvi away, put him in a detention facility in New Jersey, Nadine, young Olvi, not knowing where he was, got a lawyer. They finally found where Faisal was. And then that last very dramatic night, when Faisal, you phoned to the family and said, I'm not sure, but I think I'm being deported. They're telling us to put on civilian clothes. You both raced to the detention facility, saw at 3 in the morning, the bus pull up that's at Immigration and Naturalization Service, and these men in shackles being brought onto this bus. You prevented this deportation of one of the men, Faisal Olvi, who's here with us today, Elizabeth Ouyang, by racing to court, with Nadine racing home and calling Congress members. What happened in the court? How did Patricia Rohan, the judge in this case, stop this deportation?
She was phenomenal. You know, it was an emergency deportation order. A judge could have said, you know, I'm busy, I'm too full, I have no time to take this case. She could have said, I want to wait till I get the file. Meanwhile, minutes, precious minutes were ticking. She immediately took the request. She reviewed it. She called me in. She could tell that there was frantic on my face. She asked me to calm down. I told her, I said, Your Honor, you know, he's literally on the way to the airport. I said, you know, please, you know, we need you to sign this. There's a family and a U.S. Wife and children here. And you know, after she signed it, I said, Your Honor, that's not enough. We've got no place to fax it to. You know, he's on the way to the airport. The deportation officer is waiting for your phone call. He has instructed me that he is under orders. They're proceeding as planned. And until he receives a call from an immigration judge saying that she or he has signed an order to stay the deportation, they're going forward as planned. And so she immediately put her clerk on to try to reach the deportation officer, and his line was busy. And so I went out in the hallway to try to reach him, and I thought Nadine was on the phone with him to clear the line. And so after a few more minutes, he calls back on Bobby Kahn, Coney Island Avenue Project's director's line, who was with me, and I said, stay on the line. The judge is trying to reach you. And I raced down the hallway. And it's funny now, but it wasn't funny then. A security guard had just turned the corner, and he said, no cell phones allowed in the courtroom. And I started running, and I had no time to talk to the security officer. And I just yelled back, it's for the judge. And he chased me into the courtroom. And then the judge sees me running into the courtroom. She had already started another case. She immediately jumps off the bench, comes down to the railing, grabs the phone from me, and said, this is Patricia A. Rohan, Immigration Judge, Executive Office of Immigration Review, New York. I'm ordering that you please take Faisal Olvi off the plane. It was literally, he was on the tarmac, being about to be placed on the plane. And it was amazing. And I cannot thank Judge Rohan enough for her expeditious handling of this. She acted judiciously and expeditiously. This is before any publicity was given on this case, before any congressperson had intervened.
Congressmember Nydia Velazquez.
Subsequently, yes, Congressman Nydia Velazquez subsequently intervened after the order was signed to request Immigration and Naturalization Service that if to allow Faisal to stay because of being married to a U.S. citizen, which was important for what followed later to get the case reopened. It gave me, Judge Rohan's immediate and prompt action gave me faith in the system, a system that would not listen before, but the judicial system listened when we tried to talk to immigration at the jail, on the phone, begging and pleading, there's a mistake here. He shouldn't be deported. He's married to a U.S. citizen. There's U.S. children here. And this invisible person who drove up in that white bus with that green lettering, Immigration and Naturalization Service, never met with me in person. I begged the prison guards to let him speak to me. And the prison guard came back and said, he will not speak with you. They're under orders to take him. And so this system that will not address people as human beings failed, but the judicial system did not fail here, and it has restored my faith in the judicial system, and I hope today again that will be reaffirmed.
How are the kids dealing with this? Do they know what's at stake today, especially Devin, your oldest son? How old is he now?
He's going to be 11 on the 9th of July. Well, they know that today is an important day and it decides their father's faith. They are nervous, very nervous.
Would it matter if people are in the courthouse, if people are interested here in the New York area? It's a national show. We broadcast around the country. But where is this case being heard?
It's at 26 Federal Plaza today. It's in the 12th floor, courtroom 16, Judge Rohan's courtroom. It is an open hearing, and we welcome anyone to come.
And is it 3 o'clock this afternoon?
It's been moved up to 2:30.
2:30.
It's been moved up to 2:30.
So you had your marriage interview. How did that go?
Well, very well.
Okay. I mean, I think if I'm not mistaken, the interviewer guy's name was Valentine. He just stood over there for like 10 minutes reading the documentations, big files, thanks to Elizabeth O'Young and everybody. And I mean, he just asked me a question, one question, simple question, that where was my daughter born and where was I? And I told him, obviously, I was over there. I was the father. And I told him the medical center we was in and what time she was born.
This is Shaheen, who's 3 now.
And then I came out and made a joke, you know, as your name, she was a Valentine baby. And he laughed and he just closed and he said, you have nothing to worry about. And he says, that's nothing. He's like, I'm satisfied. You know, there's nothing there for me to ask because everything over here is pictures and documentations are talking. It's been so many years upon my lawyer, Elizabeth, that if he needs more evidence of documentation, he says it's farther enough, this good. And I mean,
last words.
I mean, everything is okay to everybody, but at least I can't blame nobody right now because, you know, there's a system, as I said, I have to go through. So this is the last step, I hope, today, 3 o'clock. This is the final hurdle I have to jump over. And in the faith of God, I'm a Muslim, and, you know, like everybody is Christian, there's only one God for everybody. And I know deep there, if nothing better would have supposed to be happening to me, I wouldn't be sitting over here today. So it got to be a right path that he had put me onto. And I hope, you know, Judge Rohan and the district attorneys, who already had interviewed me several times, they already know the situation of the case. Just take a couple of minutes and just, you know, give the word that is in favor of me and my family, my kids.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us again. It is today at 2:30 Eastern Standard Time at 26 Federal Plaza on the 12th floor, the court of Judge Patricia Rohan,
courtroom 16.
Courtroom 16. Thank you very much.
You're
Faisal Olvi, Nadine Young Olvi, and Elizabeth Ouyang, their attorney. As we wrap up this Eve of Independence Day weekend special, weekend where we celebrate a nation of immigrants with this final story about Southern California.
In the past month, immigration agents have arrested hundreds of undocumented workers and immigrants in Southern California in sweeps that are causing widespread fear and charges of racial profiling in local immigrant and Latino communities. The sweeps began on June 1st and have been conducted well inside the U.S.-Mexico border. According to local papers, border officials have picked up people at grocery stores, bus stops, and while walking down the street and driving in their cars. As many as 500 people have been arrested since the operation began. While there is significant fear in the immigrant and Latino communities, not everyone is staying home. Up to 10,000 people marched in protest in Ontario, Pomona, Pasadena, and other cities.
We're joined now by Nativa Lopez, who is executive director of the immigrant advocacy organization Hermandad Mexicana Nacional, which is based in Santa Ana. He's also head of the Mexican American Political Association. Can you describe what has taken place that's gotten almost no attention nationally?
Well, Juan did express exactly what's happening. Sweeps have been sweeps and raids are occurring in commercial areas, neighborhoods, mainly in two counties, San Bernardino and Riverside in Southern California. And more than 400 individuals have been detained. Majority of these individuals have been deported. The sweeps have been random, arbitrary, and the charges of racial profiling are very appropriate because the raids are occurring only in, or have occurred only in Latino neighborhoods, Latino shopping center areas, and only Latinos have been detained.
Nativo, for those of our listeners who are not familiar with a past history of these kinds of raids, in Southern California, of course, they're very familiar with the massive immigration deportations back in the 1950s as well, right?
That's correct.
Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, you know, it's funny because it was interpreted initially as a shift in policy because we haven't seen these kind of raids for at least 16 years. Actually, since the amnesty bill was passed in 1986, you might say there's a whole generation of immigrants in California that have not experienced these kinds of raids where individuals would summarily be rounded up in whole neighborhoods, apartment complex, commercial areas, bus terminals, detained by immigration services, loaded on a bus, and taken to the border for their deportation. So it was a very, very common occurrence until the immigration law was passed. And since then, enforcement has been focused on the border, not in the interior. So it was what appeared to be a shift. But after meeting with officials of the Border Patrol from San Diego and Temecula, where they expressed that they were in their statutory authority to conduct these raids, and that a shift had occurred, later on, members of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus met with Asa Hutchinson, the Undersecretary of Homeland Security, and he expressed that there had not been a shift and that the raids had actually occurred not authorized by his office.
We're talking with Nativo Lopez, who is head of the Mexican-American Political Association, about this round of sweeps that has taken place. It's not as if Ontario, California is close to the border. It's more than 100 miles away.
That's correct. That's correct. And the interpretation that that we've drawn from this and expressed loudly by demonstrating and the large march in Ontario of over 7,000 individuals, that our community is not Fallujah, it's not Baghdad, it's not Tukrik, under occupation by a foreign invading force. This has created terror and panic in our community. Every law enforcement vehicle is interpreted as an INS vehicle. Reports in the Spanish language media that raids are occurring throughout the state. That's not the case, but that's just the terror that has been created in our community, where literally thousands of calls that have been placed to our offices and other offices, people asking it's okay to go out and buy milk for their children, send their children to school, go to church, go to work, etc. That's the kind of terror that's been created in the Mexican community.
Can I ask you, what's been the response of your immigrant governor in California to these raids, if any?
He's been silent. He hasn't said anything about it. On the other hand, he hasn't been called on it either. At the same time, the whole debate of the whole debate of the driver's license continues to swirl here in California, and he insists that he will only sign a bill to give driver's license if it has some type of a mark or an indication that the individual that is the bearer of that driver's license is a undocumented immigrant.
We also hear Clear Channel shock jocks are calling to have people call your offices and fill up your phone lines, make them busy, and calling for the detention and more sweeps.
Absolutely. It's KFI... The John and Ken Show, 6:40 a.m., is affiliated with the Clear Channel and other Clear Channel shock jocks throughout the state, actually announcing the telephone number of the Border Patrol for people to call in. The Border Patrol applaud them for their work and to call them to encourage additional raids, and also publicizing the offices of Hermandad Mexicana, our telephone numbers, and asking people to call us to demand that we stop advocating against the immigration raids. And we actually received well over 1,000 calls threats, ugly...
Nativa Lopez, we have to end it there. I want to thank you for being with us tonight. I'll be at the University of Alberta, Edmonton, Canada, tomorrow, University of San Francisco, at the Action Coalition for Media Education Summit, then KZYX on Friday and Saturday at the Cleveland Convention Center. Check the website. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Fabio Caduz, Jeremy Scahill, Anna Nogueira, John Hamilton, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.